From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, Abdulrahim Fukara, Al Jazeera's Regional Director for the Americas, Tom DeFrank, contributor to the National Journal, and our moderator, Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. With just over 2 months left before the U.S. presidential election, President Donald Trump and Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden took their campaigns on the road after their respective party conventions, with each candidate taking very different positions on the COVID-19 pandemic and continuing protests over racial injustice. Protests continued in Portland, Oregon, Kenosha, Wisconsin, and other U.S. cities, fueled by outrage over the recent shooting of Jacob Blake 7 times in the back by a police officer in Kenosha. The response to the protests by public officials and by the public at large reveal an America that is bitterly divided. Both the public and private sector are responding to reports of foreign interference in the U.S. elections. Facebook found Russian interference on Facebook again, using many of the same assets that were employed in the 2016 election. Meanwhile, the Director of National Intelligence announced that he would cease delivering in-person intelligence reports to Congress. India is fast becoming the globe's new coronavirus epicenter. It has been reporting the highest single-day caseload in the world for nearly 3 weeks. In the United States, the current epicenter, the response continued to be inconsistent as states deal with the virus coming into a holiday weekend that could lead to another national flare-up of the disease. And a senior State Department official says the United States is considering imposing sanctions on 7 Belarusians it believes were involved in falsifying the results of the August 9th election and in violence against peaceful protesters. Belarusian opposition leader Svetlana Tsikhanouskaya said, "The Belarusian people have a responsibility for what's going on. We think that we have to solve this problem by ourselves." Gentlemen, welcome to another busy week. And I want to get started with the election campaign. As we say, there's just over 2 months left before the U.S. presidential campaign. The next big milestone will be the debates that are being held between President Trump and former Vice President Biden. But we're seeing the campaign start to take shape in their direction. We're seeing sort of a firming up of their messages. And it strikes me how different they are from when it first started, when you had President Trump talking at the beginning of his campaign about the economy and Joe Biden talking about being a middle-of-the-road candidate and certainly other things he was talking about. Both of them have taken very different tacks. I'll start with you, Tom. President Trump is leaning heavily on bleak depictions of chaos in the cities and refusing to acknowledge really the victims of the police shootings. Is this a winning strategy for him? Can he govern, much less win, by acknowledging only his base in this way?
Well, I think he can govern, but with great difficulty. It's possible he can win. And a matter of fact, the Trump campaign believes this law and order hardline strategy is what got him elected 4 years ago. We all recall, Michael, how he talked about there were thousands of illegal immigrants heading toward the southern border of the United States, poised to invade our country. And after the election, the crowds kind of magically disappeared. But that was a good argument for him. And so he's trying to, in effect, double down on that this time. And there is rioting and looting and protesting in some major cities, Portland, Oregon, more recently Kenosha, Wisconsin, where both Biden and President Trump have been or are about to go in recent days. And so the Trump people, think that the law and order issue is his strongest at the moment. On the other hand, Vice President Biden is ramping up his critique of the president's coronavirus strategy, saying thousands more Americans have died who would not have died if the president had been on the case early on. And I think both these strategies are going to be in very sharp relief at the first debate on the 29th of September.
Yeah, I kind of agree with you there, Tommy. And Abdulrahim, I'll go to you now. There are two points that really struck me about how firmly and forcefully the president is going for what he believes is a particular audience, it seems to me, that is going to carry the day for him in the election. And the two things that I noted are his support for Kyle Rittenhouse, who was a 17-year-old Trump supporter who killed two people with an assault rifle during protests in Wisconsin. He tweeted support for that person, and he also compared the shooting of Jacob Blake by that police officer to someone choking in sports. I believe he compared it to missing a 3-foot putt in golf. Now, this may seem callous to some, but to others, it seems reasonable. And how do you break down the sort of disparate responses to these very, I mean, obviously provocative statements by the president?
Thanks, Michael. And first of all, I haven't seen Tommy in person for a long, long time, but I love his voice and I love hearing it. It's great to hear it today. If I may say something very quickly about Biden, first of all, I mean, I'd like to think of Biden as someone who was wearing two different masks, one real, one metaphorical. The real one he still wears, obviously. The metaphorical he only began to remove recently when he started to direct pointed attacks and respond in pointed ways to President Donald Trump. President Donald Trump seems to have found a foothold in Biden's previously described as great chances of making it on the 3rd of November by focusing a lot more on the issue of law and order. And it seems to me that in addition to Portland, Kenosha has come as something of a, as someone described it, a poisoned gift for Donald Trump, because he's been able to make these points, these two points that you have mentioned in very pointed ways. President Trump, as we all know, he has a lot of skill in being able to straddle certain lines, saying things without actually saying them, straddling lines in ways that, you know, seem to indicate that he is about to break the law, but he doesn't, at the end of the day, really break the law. And what he said about the 17-year-old white guy in Kenosha is a good case in point. He didn't seem to go all the way and say that he supported what he did, but he did go so far as to say that, you know, if he had been in his position, he would have done the same thing, meaning that the 17-year-old had come under attack and he was defending himself. And this seems to appeal to certain parts of the voters who are maybe still not decided between Trump and Biden, who do feel that, you know, recent events in Kenosha and Portland are sort of undermining their faith in the security of the United States going forward. And obviously that poses a very serious challenge to Biden, and little wonder that we have seen, at least if you do trust what polls are saying, and we know from the experience of 2016 that we're not always advised to do so. Right. But if you believe what polls are saying, Trump's support does seem to have receded somewhat in recent days.
I want to move on to another topic where the two campaigns, the two candidates diverge, it seems. And that's the subject of COVID-19, the pandemic. And you have President Trump on one side who's seeming to turn away from the more trusted advisor, Tony Fauci. I don't know if it's really disfavor, but he certainly is not front and center and forward in the administration's response. Deborah Birx, who was at one time the face of the pandemic response, has now been put on the sidelines, so to speak. And you have different CDC guidelines that are encouraging opening up, discouraging frequent testing, and even have the president sort of retreating and in some ways propagating these internet theories that are saying that only 6,000 deaths are attributable to COVID-19. On the other hand, you have Joe Biden who's saying that he wants to put the scientists up front. He's saying that he would, if he needed to, make a national shutdown. He would implement national mask wearing. Two very disparate responses to this. Tom, how can a voter take a look at this and find reason where there seems to be no middle? There used to be a middle ground in these things and some sort of overlap, but there seems to be not even any overlap in the responses of the two candidates.
None whatsoever. Their views of the reality are very, very different. You have the president basically saying it's better than you think and that the number of new cases is going down, which is correct. On the other hand, the death rate is still growing. It's still around 1,000 deaths per day. The estimates are, from reasonable people, are that you could have 200,000 COVID deaths by the end of this month, September. And so they're just diametrically opposed. Trump is clearly hoping to be able to make the case that it's getting better, and it's getting better because of his policies. Biden is trying to make the point that it's getting worse, and it should have been a lot better were it not for President Trump's halting policies. It's who you want to believe, but you're quite right. Their views of what's happening on the ground and what needs to be done next are diametrically opposite.
And that sort of takes me into our next subject, which is very closely related to what we're talking about now, which is the protests themselves. As we said in the open, protests are continuing in Portland, Oregon, and Kenosha, Wisconsin, and in other cities, too, not only in the United States, but around the world. And the protest seems to have no sign of letting up and are currently as much in the spotlight as COVID-19 or the economy would normally be in an election cycle. Abdur-Rahim, some characterize, again, we're just going to talk about this juxtaposition all day, the divergence of the two opinions in America. Some characterize the protest as peaceful. Some look at the exact same scene and we'll see violence. I want to ask you a question. Is it possible that both can be right, but neither is acknowledging the other?
Allow me to go one step beyond that and make the general point that remember that about 10 weeks ago, everybody was saying it had become a given to say that the president, the way he handled the coronavirus situation in the United States, is ineffectual. And everybody was sort of giving up hope, certainly many of his critics, that he could ever have a chance in November. With Portland, Kenosha, and other flashpoints that you alluded to up and down the country, it has become more recently evident that something extraordinary is happening, that despite his failures in dealing with terrible failures, as his critics would say, in dealing with coronavirus, we are now talking about 6 million infected Americans. We're talking about, you know, tens of thousands of deaths. And yet here we are just a few weeks away from November 3rd. Donald Trump, by some metrics, is actually on the offensive, and Biden seems to be on the defensive at this particular point in time, because Biden wants to focus on the coronavirus. Many Americans are now elsewhere in the debate and with their attention. They're focusing on the violence and the protests and the racism in Kenosha and other parts of the United States. But the fact remains that we probably are going to be seeing this football continue. One day, Trump looks like he's doing really well. Another day, Biden will look like he's doing really well. But, you know, it is fascinating that despite all his perceived or real failures, Donald Trump is still in with a chance now. There are people who still believe that he can make it on November 3rd, regardless of what he sees at this particular point in time in the eyes of critics as the major issue, as opposed to the coronavirus being still the major issue for the Democrats and particularly for Joseph Biden.
Abdur-Rahim makes a great point that these issues have given a foothold to what seemed to be, for a moment, a floundering Trump campaign. And the message seems to be that this is a time of chaos. It's a time of widespread violence and uncertainty. And I am the person who can stop this, says President Trump. He is also the person who created this. I mean, he is actually the president right now. And not that he personally set fire to a building, but he certainly is responsible for what happens on his watch. He's been president for 4 years. How does he effectively escape responsibility for something that happened on his watch?
These protests and the looting and things like that have, I wouldn't say they have resuscitated President Trump, because presidents have the powers of incumbency, and it was always obvious that the race was going to close. But it's not clear whether this will continue to help him. It has helped him, and I think Biden is somewhat on the defensive. I mean, President Trump has been trying to come up with epithets for Biden, and now he's calling him Joe Hyden, as in hiding in his basement in Delaware. And whether that's fair or not, the voters will decide. But it is true that all of a sudden, Joe Biden is leaving his home of Delaware and traveling to other states, which tells you something's going on out there that the Biden campaign feels the need to respond to.
Indeed. The Biden campaign has been much more visible. The candidate has been much more visible in recent days. He's taking a visit to Kenosha, Wisconsin, where the president visited recently. And I expect that the tone, tenor, and substance of the trip, as with all of their tactics and messages, will be quite different than the president's. We'll stop there, take a break, and we'll be back with more Issues in the News.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Abdulrahim Fukara, Al Jazeera's Regional Director for the Americas, Tom DeFrank, contributor to the National Journal, and our moderator, Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome back to Issues in the News. Gentlemen, let's turn to the issue of foreign election interference in the United States presidential elections. It seems that the prospect of foreign interference is stronger than ever this after 4 years of warnings, of reports, of investigations. The prospect seems to be stronger than ever. This from the Washington Post. Facebook removed a network of fake accounts and pages created by Russian operatives who had recruited U.S. journalists to write articles critical of Democratic nominee Joe Biden and his running mate Senator Kamala Harris in an apparent bid to undermine their support among liberal voters. This is a fascinating story that reveals a web of actors and assets spanning the globe. Abdulrahim, I'll start with you. The meddling really hasn't stopped since 2016. This is clear and apparent. Is the U.S. prepared to deal with this?
First of all, going back to 2016, I mean, we have to remind everyone that, you know, while the Democrats have been saying that the Russians have interfered to help Donald Trump win the election, Donald Trump is saying that the Russians did interfere, but they interfered to help Hillary Clinton back in 2016. So in Donald Trump's mind and in the Democrats' mind, that has not been resolved and it will probably never be resolved. Secondly, I mean, it seems to me that if you are the biggest, strongest kid on the block, then all the other people around you will want to know exactly how you think so as to be able to influence it. I mean, all these reports are now saying that it's not just the Russians. It's the Russians, it's the Chinese, it's the Iranians, it's the Saudis. Everybody is trying to get in on the act of trying to influence U.S. elections. This is obviously a crucial election, not just for Americans. It's a crucial election to the rest of the world, depending on whether Donald Trump wins a second term or if he'll have a Democrat in the White House. A lot of countries will base their policies on the choice that Americans make on November 3rd, except that a problem does happen if you have a lot of foreign powers interfering in U.S. election. You also, because this is a democracy, it has to reflect the will of the American people. Then you get a real situation there between what the will of the people is inside the United States and what the will of the outside powers trying to influence the will of Americans.
I think it's a very good point that I remember when people ask, why do athletes use steroids and other performance-enhancing drugs? And the short answer is because it works. And I think that there's some clear evidence that election meddling has been effective in some ways for those outside agents. So I'm going to go to you. We have a recent report by the Republican-led Senate Intelligence Committee that detailed grave counterintelligence threat posed by Russia. Virtually at the same time, we have the Director of National Intelligence in the U.S., John Ratcliffe, who is sort of the intelligence liaison between the Trump administration and the U.S. Congress, decide to stop reporting in person. He's not going to give all reports to them, which means that there are no Q&A, question and answer session, that can be held between elected officials and the administration. What is the significance of that? Because to a longtime resident like myself, I'm sure to one like yourself, when you throw around words like unprecedented a lot during this administration, but to me, this is especially deserving of that term, unprecedented.
It definitely is unprecedented, Michael. Mr. Ratcliffe is a former congressman from Texas not particularly distinguished. He came to President Trump's attention when he was a strong defender of President Trump during the impeachment hearings and many other hearings, and he became the director of national intelligence. And anybody who thinks that this decision was made by Mr. Radcliffe is not paying attention. This is a decision clearly mandated by the White House. The significance is that between now and the election, there will be no chance for the Senate Intelligence Committee to push back, so to speak, against anything the administration is telling them about foreign influence in the election. Now, it's clear the Russians and others are trying to meddle. What's not clear is vigorously the administration is pushing back on that. We don't know. But I think this new decision by Mr. Radcliffe will not last long after the election, I think, whether President Trump wins or is defeated.
We'll just have to see exactly what the damage is and how effective this will be. And does Congress have any ability to push back on this? Do they really have the teeth? We've seen that subpoenas and other requests for documents have been routinely ignored by the administration. It's hard to believe that this one will be treated any differently. Let's move on to the COVID-19 pandemic and the situation around the world. India, again, reporting around 70,000 cases daily. It's in the United States. States that were hit hard early are cautiously opening, continuing their opening process while the pandemic is starting to flare up in the Midwest and still continues to rage in some of the southern states. We have the looming challenge of the Labor Day holiday, one of the largest travel and, I'd say, social holidays in the United States, right around the corner, and school openings that are happening now and will continue to happen towards the beginning of September. Abdulrahim, I want to start with you. The rise of cases in India and the continued struggle with the virus in Europe and other parts of the world and in the U.S., I believe that the message is that the pandemic is not under control, but is that the message that you're getting?
Partly. The other message that I'm also getting from various parts of the world is not very incompatible with the message that we're witnessing here in the United States, which is that as opposed to what was happening 5 months ago when most of the people in America and around the world were afraid, they were staying at home, they were keeping their children at home 24/7. We have seen a move to sort of adapt to having the coronavirus as the extra member of your family. I think on one hand, we have talk of an imminent vaccine, whether we should believe that or not, for the coronavirus. But at the same time, we have people who are worried about their livelihood. It's the same in the US, the same in India, same everywhere else. And it seems that, you know, governments around the world, and India is a very good case in point with a population of over 1 billion people and a sort of paralyzed economy and a lot more poverty than in many other parts of the world, including the United States, they've come to the conclusion that at the end of the day, you have to somehow reopen the economy. You have to allow people to make a living because not everybody is willing or able to stay at home without being able to feed their children, pay rent, and so on and so forth. So to me, that's a very big part of the message that this epidemic is here to stay with us for an indeterminate period of time.
Now, as we finish here, I want to talk about public trust. Public trust for large organizations like the World Health Organization and the Center for Disease Control. It seems that public trust is being eroded. Some of it seems to be intentional by politicians and policy people. So as we face that challenge, who are people looking to for the truth? Who can you trust? And how can science win out? How can a vaccine win out? And some people don't even trust the people who are producing it.
I think we're heading into a period here where two things are important. What happens when tens of millions of American students go back to school? There's already instances of colleges who've started classes and then come big outbreaks, and so these colleges have had to suspend classes after a week or 2 weeks. If that keeps going on, that's going to further erode public confidence. But the other thing is the economy. By the time we come on these microphones in another week, we will have new unemployment figures in this country. We will have new economic activity data. And so all of these things will feed in for good or ill
Indeed. And gentlemen, I'm afraid that's all the time we have. Thanks to Tom DeFrank, contributor to the National Journal, and Abdurrahim Fukara, Al Jazeera's regional director for the Americas. This program is produced by the Voice of America. I'm Michael Williams. Thanks for listening.